today hosting Investing Simplified is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney. You can call Carl now at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. Or for our long distance and podcast listeners, you can call toll free at 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. Now here's the host of Investing Simplified, Carl Jepsen.
Well, good morning. It is Investing Simplified this Memorial Day weekend, and I hope that you all are traveling safe and carefully, and that you're thinking of all of those people who gave their lives for the rest of us. And I hope that you have some fun at the same time. Sounds like we're going to have a pretty decent weather weekend, and looks pretty nice now. In the studio today with me, I have Mr. Kevin Stege.
Good morning, Carl. I'll put my coffee down and say hi.
Well, there you go. And on top of that, we have the spirit of Chuck Price in the other side of the seat here. Chuck is called out of town this week. So once again, you're stuck with a dynamic duo here. But so even though we can't give you much by way of stock and financial planning advice, other than to say, buy low and sell high. But beyond that, we probably don't give you a whole lot. But taxes, estate planning, legal stuff, accounting stuff, we're ready for your calls. And if you really want to, get your day started right and it's been bothering you about this, that, or the other thing about your taxes or about your estate planning, then please give us a call, because that's what makes this show really work, is the interaction with you, the listener. That's why we do this. We try to provide you with useful information. Understand, of course, that it's never specific legal advice or accounting advice to you, but rather general information that of an educational value that gives you some direction based upon what your circumstances might be. But in order to get real legal advice or tax advice that you need to that you want to rely upon for making your decisions, you really need to have someone look at your materials, look at your records, and really sit down and develop that professional relationship so that you can, make sure that you're all on the same page. So having said that, telephone numbers are 503-417-9595, or if you're out of the area, 877-733-1011. So, Kevin, you are the tax investigator today. Maybe you should do Carl's comments.
Well, I was looking forward to hearing you talk about hedging your derivatives with leveraged options.
I do that a lot.
Do you?
I do, yeah. I don't even know what that means. Do you?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. That's very good. Very good. I think that's a Chuck question.
Yeah, I think it is.
Hedging your, with the derivatives, I know what that is. That's stuff that comes from something else.
That's a good, is that attorney-ese?
That's the legal definition
of
that.
Okay, yeah, very good.
So anyway, yeah, there used to be those, the default swap things and all of that that were around that kind of in part created the crash of 2008.
That's right.
And, so anything that says derivative sounds, bad.
Yeah, just save those for next week when Chuck's back.
And wasn't there some kind of I think I recall way back when, I don't know whether it was calculus or some other math course that I took, there were something called a derivative, and I have no idea what it was now. So, calculators, that's what they're for.
That's right.
There you go. So anyway, we're going to talk about anything you, the listener, wants to talk about, and we're going to talk about a few things that come up in the practice. One thing, here's my lead-off thing. There was an article written, or actually it was a column in the Oregonian a while back, and I was just kind of thumbing through stuff the other day, and the caption says, "Parents shouldn't rely on unwritten pact to divide estate." And I thought, wonder what that's about. So I think it's worth listening to at least the question, because the answer is interesting, not necessarily interesting, but basically this, it says, "My parents are establishing a marital trust that calls for my brother Richard to inherit both of the homes they own. That's roughly two-thirds of their estate, with the remaining one-third going to my sister and me. Richard and his family live rent-free in one of these houses, and my parents live in the other, a mountain home that Richard says he loves. Mom and Dad want to make the three of us co-trustees, and they've told us they expect us to have an, quote, written agreement, close quote, that my brother will pay my sister and me the difference between the much larger share of the estate and ours. This, quote, agreement, close quote, seems crazy to me. Just for starters, unless Richard sold the house he lives in, he wouldn't have the money to make my sister and me whole. Should I ask for my parents about concerns? Well, whoever answered them basically went on to say, yeah, that's pretty darn stupid, and you ought to sit down with your mom and dad right away. And I think that this kind of thing happens, quite frankly, in my practice, with all good intentions. People come and they say, well, I don't want, you know, this is kind of what we've been doing, and you know, he's kind of the leader, or you know, he's kind of the, you know, he's a really trustworthy guy, and, you know, we don't want to have any kind of big bunch of rules, because they'll feel like they, you know, like they're not really part of the family, and that they're, you know, and I just want to remind you, there are three fundamental rules of contract law. Get it in writing. There are no other fundamental laws of contract law. Oh, it helps to write it in English for most of us. But anyway, the problem being is that a lot of times it is amazing. And I think even the best of circumstances, the best of families, don't know the kinds of circumstances that will happen. Or maybe they do and they just don't like to admit it. They don't want to say, you know, I know there's going to be trouble and I don't want to make any more for me right now. I don't want my son to know that this is what we did because he's going to be mad at me. Well, how about daughters? You know, so it's a real important thing. And quite frankly, it's your money. It's your stuff. It's your house. So, you know, tell them straight. Tell them straight and make sure that if you have in mind a certain kind of disposition in your estate plan, make sure that your attorney puts it together that way so that that's how the distribution is supposed to go and so that it's enforceable by the parties, because sometimes they change their minds. Their loyalties, their, you know, all of a sudden, you know, mom loved you better is no longer good enough. And so it's really, really important to And if there's no, in fact, I had a lawsuit here some years ago involving four brothers, and the real issue had to do with the one brother's understanding of what he was supposed to get in terms of this particular real property. And it was, the difference was about an 8-foot strip along the side of a wall. And we had a, you know, 2-year lawsuit with, and it went to the Court of Appeals, and we won all of the way, but it cost a whole lot of money. And instead of deeding the 8-foot strip to the, you know, to the one, the complaining brother, we actually offered to give a perpetual easement over this foot and let the guy use it just as though it was his. But that wasn't good enough because mom told him, Uncle Harry told him, Cousin Johnny told him, and, you know, everybody told him that this was supposed to be his property to do with as he pleased, right up to the very wall, which is kind of stupid when you think about it. But nonetheless, this is what happened. And so we won all of the way. He didn't do that. And it was very frustrating for everybody. It cost a whole bunch of money. And it almost destroyed the family. And in fact, parts of it have not been, you know, satisfied yet. So the thought is, had it been in writing, it would have been correct. It would have been enforceable, and there shouldn't have been the fight that there was. That was what was the winning thing, was we had the lawyer there who drafted the trust. And the lawyer said, that's the way it's supposed to be. I know that's the way it's supposed to be because that's what my client told me. And this is the drawing that we made, and this is where she drew the property line and all of that stuff. And even in the face of that, we ended up going all the way to the Court of Appeals. So that's kind of the kinds of things I'm suggesting is, and I'm suggesting about this particular article is, you know, you don't want to leave yourself, you don't want to leave it up to those unwritten, you know, mouth-to-mouth agreements. It's not a good deal.
Well, it sounds to me like the moral of the story here is all the land you really ever needed was 6 feet. You know that?
Oh yeah. No, yeah. I could have. Yeah.
Well, you know, you get. I know you really look at the relational dynamics in a lot of the work that you do. after hearing that article and the facts behind it, my mind was thinking, well, how could you have affected that, you know, what they wanted in a way that would work legally? And it seems to me if they had just given the property one-third, 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 then the remaining, the guy who wanted the property, he could have executed a sale that...
There are a number of ways that people can fix stuff, mm-hmm. and to put it kind of in stone so that it can be enforced the way they want it. The problem is a lot of times people just don't think that way. They're thinking in terms of relational circumstances and those dynamics, as you mentioned. They're not thinking in terms of how this structures out as a land deal, or how this structures out as a business deal, or whatever it is. They're looking at it more as a relationship, which is fine, except that it's harder to enforce a relationship in court than it is to enforce an agreement.
Do you think sometimes a situation like this would work? Say one of the two who was left out of the land deal here, what if they had like extremely bad credit, or there was a bankruptcy coming up and they didn't want that child to get assets and then lose it? Maybe this was a kind of under the table way of, or maybe the parent thought, you know, at the time that something like that would happen, or maybe one of the other two was, had a substance problem, and maybe a trust is a better way, though.
I think a lot of times that's true, that those kind of considerations are in play. But if that's what you're doing, you know, if you're saying, look, I'm really trying to treat this fellow fairly, or this girl fairly, but we don't really, you know, she hasn't demonstrated good judgment over the years, and we want to make sure that someone, you know, protects her from herself. Say so in the documents. That's the important part. You know, say what you mean. it's very important. And a lot of lawyers forget that. You know, they get the, you know, party of the first part and the second part right, but they lose sight of what is it that we're trying to do, and what is the intent behind this. And I think one of the best ways to do that is say, by doing this, I'm intending this to happen, or this is how it's supposed to work, or, you know, words to that effect. And now that may not sound like legalese, but everybody understands it, and it tends to work. So, yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing. I imagine this comes up in the tax consequence or tax situation too. I would suppose as to the people do things that they think are going to be helpful from a family standpoint that screw up the tax, you know.
Absolutely, especially, you know, gifting, that type of a thing. A lot of times, you know, somebody or you know, transferring a property, you know, we'll get the idea of what happened after the fact. And the client says, this happened. And it's just like, whoa, that's a significant transaction that's going to have tax implications. Mm-hmm. And so, those things do happen.
Oh, yeah. Well, it does happen a lot in family, you know, transactions of all sorts. You know, I'm always reminded, do you remember the television show Dallas?
I do.
Well,
JR.
Remember, they were always into those. You know, there's JR and Bobby and you know, they're always messing with each other, you know? So, you know, and they never wrote down anything. You know, I mean, it was all just sort of, oh yeah, sure, Bobby, I'll take care of you, boy. You know?
I just had a client tell me that a deal was I wanted some documentation on a deal, and they said no, there's no documentation. This was done Alaskan style, and that's what.
Texas style.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you have those kind of agreements and they go south, then you have dispute resolution Texas style. And that's in like 20 paces. So anyway, we're going to take a quick break. If you want to make a call to us and, you know, find out how we learn all these wonderful things about Texas and Alaska, you can call us at 503-417-9595 and 877-733-1011. We'll be back with Investing Simplified in just a moment.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask Kevin Stege, CPA and shareholder of the Baker Coulson CPA firm, that tax question that's been keeping you up at night. You can call Kevin 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's the CPA with the tax answers, Kevin Stege.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified, and we do encourage your calls. Looks like the lines are open. It's been pretty quiet here this morning. People must be out enjoying their 3 or 4 or 5 day weekend with the nice weather and traveling around. It's the busiest travel day of the year sometimes?
It is. It's, bumper to bumper day.
Yeah, exactly. 503-417-9595 in the Portland area, 877-733-1011 if you're outside of the area. Of course, again, Chuck is not with us. At least he's with us on the earth, but not in the studio. So today on the Tax Investigator, we are going to talk about rentals. And I thought I would just cover some basic information. And Carl, I welcome any of your questions or thoughts as we go through here, if I'm clear as mud or need to go into more detail. But sometimes too much detail in this area is too much detail. And so I'll just generally touch on some things and not, again, giving specific tax advice to your situation.
Well, I think that the number one thing that I think people maybe misunderstand about rentals, and I'm not sure that I understand entirely, is the kind of the relationship between, you know, what kinds of things are depreciable, what kinds of things are deductible, and how is the income reported? I mean, those are kind of
exactly.
Is that a pretty good lead for you there?
That's a very good lead. That's where we're headed. And I'd say the first thing is if you're thinking about getting into rentals or buying a rental, be very careful not to let the tax tail wag the dog, because I think to steal off of your comment earlier, location, location, location is going to be very important, as it always is with real estate. Number one, and number two is you don't want landlord tenant issues. If that comes into play, I don't care how much tax savings you have or so on and so forth. That's a headache that nobody wants. And but if you have a good location, good price, good value, you think, when you're going to be purchasing this property, and maybe there's already a tenant in it, or you have a good management company that can get you a good tenant, if you have a good tenant in there, it's worth their weight in gold, and keep that rental price so that they're happy and want to stay, because you could up the price by $100, chase them off, and you'll rue the day, probably.
Well, there's a movie called Pacific Heights. If you want to see it stars, I forget the fellow's name. He was a famous actor. He played Batman once. Michael something.
Keaton?
Keaton, Michael Keaton. And he's a bad guy tenant in this thing. And Pacific Heights. And if you want to see how extreme and how awful a tenant can become, and this is not actually that far from the truth, quite frankly, watch that movie, Pacific Heights. That'll cure you from you know, lusting after too many rentals.
You know, I had a client who had a landlord-tenant dispute going on, and they got a call one day from Judge Joe Brown's office and asked if they would like to settle this down in California on TV. So that's not what you want at the end of your rental story.
You know, I actually had a neighbor dispute where Judge Judy's office called. And this was way before I instructed my legal assistant to come in and beat me, you know, senseless with my dictation machine if I even thought about taking a neighbor dispute. But that we wanted to resolve, and I said, no, I don't think so. So anyway.
I see the dent where that machine hit you. So,
yeah, no kidding. I got beat a lot, you know. So anyway, well, so you were going on with with the rental stuff and
exactly. So basically, if you've got a good rental lined up, you've got a good tenant maybe, or you're going to go down that road. First thing is, and we've talked it ad nauseum in the past about probably putting something like this in an LLC, especially if you're starting to get multiple rentals or it's a multi-family housing unit. LLC is a good way to go. Single member, multi-member, that's something you'll want to plan. And so we've talked about that before in the past. Next thing is, it sounds like we
do have a caller. Chris is on the line. Chris, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
How can we help you?
Well, I've got this, piece of timberland. It's roughly a 350 acre piece of timberland that, my grandmother and great aunt owned. It's been in the family since the 1880s. And, in 2002, my wife and I had an opportunity to purchase my great aunt's interest and ended up becoming a property owner with my grandmother, her sister. And so my grandma and I were owners of this timberland until her unfortunate passing in 2004, so we were owners together for a couple of years before she passed, and so we're purchasing my great aunt's half on contract. I've been making payments to her since 2002, and when my grandmother passed away in 2004, my grandmother's half of the property went to my mother, and my mom and I, we have a good relationship. I have three brothers. Not knowing what her will situation is like and what she's going to do with her half of the property that she passed, just brought a rise concerns between my wife and I of what can my brothers do, if anything, upon my mother's passing with my mother's half in the event they try and force us sell the property. I just have some concerns. How best can I protect myself at this point?
Okay. Let me make sure I understand. I'm going to try to put this short. You and your wife own half of it by virtue of purchasing it on a land sale contract of some sort.
Correct.
And your mom owns the other half, which at some point in time will be subject to her probate, and you anticipate that half is going to go to the other family members.
I'm not knowing what my mother's plans are. I sure would like to know what her plans are, but I just don't know. Maybe she gives a quarter of her half to each of the four boys. I don't know.
Well, here's the thing, and it would depend apart a lot on what she's done, and hopefully she's seen a lawyer about how she might want to do that sort of thing. But I would say that it might be, you know, as long as everybody has a reasonably good relationship, probably the first thing you ought to do is talk with mom about, well, what are we going to do about this when, you know, because, you know, I don't want to have a fight on my hands, and nobody wants to have a fight on their hands after mom dies, so... So, and I presume mom wants to just keep it in the family for now, anyway. And now here's an interesting issue is what happens if, in this half interest, is it a separate part? I mean, in other words, do you own a specific half or is it just half of the total?
So the way that the deed reads is it's the undivided one half interest of the property.
Okay, and so that means that the others are going to be an undivided one half of the property. So they're what we call tenants in common. And you'll have to listen to Carl's comments. I'm going to talk extensively about that here just later on. But so I would, first of all, if that's a possibility, you know, obviously if it's going to cause a family fight, you don't want to do that either. But if you think it would be worthwhile to try to set something up in advance, and you know, maybe meet with a lawyer that could assist you in structuring the thing. One of the things you might look at, especially with maybe something like Timberland, at some point in time, would be to, you know, you could do it with an LLC. You could put the property in an LLC, but you could also, you know, have some kind of a partnership. But I think it's probably simpler to do it with an LLC, or even just as tenants in common, but have an agreement somehow that allows for, you know, like a buyout kind of thing, but not force a buyout. And because here's the end of the line would be, let's suppose that mom passed away next week, and she, you know, and so you and your brothers, and let's suppose you want to keep the thing, and your other siblings say, no, we want to cash it out. Well, you got a real issue there. And so
that's what I'm worried about.
Yeah. Well. Here's what could happen. The worst thing that happens is that one, the person who wants to get cashed out, if they can't come to some kind of an agreement as to how that gets done, what they end up doing is they file what's called a partition suit, and that is a lawsuit that tries to force the partitioning of the property. The problem is that if it can't be partitioned, okay, let's suppose that legally it can't be partitioned. Maybe, you know, you never know. A lot of times the various zoning and kinds of regulations make it impossible to partition and actually divide up into pieces. Then the court can force a sale. So, and that can be messy, especially, you know, timberland, it can have some very valuable timber, but it kind of varies during the market time. You know, I don't know what it's like now, but I know that sometimes it's worth a lot more than it is maybe today or vice versa. So that's not a good thing, because then basically what happens is the if you have to have that kind of a sale, you know, it's essentially like a fire sale. You may be not, I mean, the timing may be bad. There may not be a good buyer, and the buyer's going to know that it's going to be a forced sale, and so they're going to squeeze you. So, right. So it seems to me that everybody's interests are settled better by having an agreement, a discussion, and even if there's disagreement, you might even consider hiring a professional mediator who's knowledgeable in real estate, you know, a real estate lawyer or somebody who can sit down and you know, say, fashion a remedy and point out the, you know, the good points and the bad points and the expensive points and the pitfalls of doing nothing. And that way you could have this thing all in place so that, you know, when mom passes away, you already know what you can or cannot do. And there's a variety of things that could be done, you know, certain kinds of buyout agreements kind of things and options and, you know, who knows what. So, you know, you'd have to sit down.
Worst case scenario, I could potentially go to that partition sale because my mom is non-confrontational, doesn't want to talk about it, it's none of our business type of thing, and over the course of the last 12 years, I've been able to work with the county to create a tremendous amount of underlying land value by recognizing the property has legal lots of record, which are very valuable in this area for residential use, even though it's a forestry piece of forestry zone property. We meet the criteria for the legal lot of record, and now my brothers see the dollar signs are in their eyes, and now I'm like, oh, great.
Well, I know you're thinking that things. I think it's a lot easier, even though they don't like to talk about it. It's none of your business, but if you can at least that kind of thing, I found that the mediation process often, you know, usually you have a mediation if you have a lawsuit, and so it's a lot more pleasant if you have it before the lawsuit so that you can hear the same thing, which is, if you don't do these things, here's the possible outcomes and here's how much it's going to cost you to get there. And so you might want to think about a good agreement beforehand. And like I said, I would if you could get perhaps your brothers and sisters to agree to that kind of a plan. I mean, in other words, you're not obligated to do anything. All you're obligated to do is sit and listen and try to figure out an agreement. If we can't figure it out, then so be it. We'll just deal with it. But at least make an effort, because I think being informed by someone who knows what the law is and what the consequences of not doing anything might be could be far worse than you know, listening to the options, and you know, because they're not obligated to do anything. A mediator does nothing but try to bring the parties to agreement. So it's not it, now they do charge money to do that, and there are a number of them that are very skillful in doing so. In fact, I could even give you some names if you wanted to later on, and you wanted to call me at my office, but everybody's got to get on the page to do that, and it's well worth. It's well worth the price of admission. It really is. So, even now, obviously, you can't make people to show up at this thing either. So, you know, there's a little bit of a challenge. But if people realize that there's a potential, you know, and you're trying to avoid that potential for dispute and very expensive dispute, mind you, very expensive, then you know it only makes good sense. Everybody comes away more a winner, and everybody comes away with more money if you do it that way than if you go the litigation route.
Very good. Thank you very much for your help.
You bet. Nice talking with you, Chris.
Uh-huh.
Well, say, I think we have another call. Cody's on the line, and I think he must be calling for Mr. Tax Investigator, I hope.
Well, shall we take a quick break and come back to Cody? No?
Nope. Cody, are you on the line?
I am. Thank you guys for taking the call. Good morning.
Well, good morning. It sounds like you, from what I see on my screen, it looks like you need to talk to Kevin here.
Hello, yeah, Cody. How can we help you?
Well, basically, I have a question about UBIT taxes, unrelated business income taxes, as they related to self-directed IRAs. I invest in non-performing promissory notes secured by real estate. And I do that in a self-directed IRA. But the most important part, I think, is I also use joint venture money with folks who also are accessing funds from a self-directed IRA. And so depending on the exit we do on that particular secured promissory note, I want to make sure that when I'm talking to potential joint venture partners, that I am intelligent on explaining to them the potential of UBIT taxes within their self-directed IRA. And so I thought I'd give you guys, I was driving to a meeting this morning and heard you guys and go, maybe these guys have bounced this question off.
And your exact question is?
Well, my exact question is when will, what type of event would trigger UBIT taxes being imposed on an investment with self-directed IRAs?
Okay. Basically, That's a very broad question to start with, but in general, when you have you sounds like you already know some of the rules, but when you have over $1,000 of UBIT, unrelated business income tax, then a tax return is required for that IRA, and it's a pretty significant tax return. It's a $5,500. I have not. I don't specialize in those. I actually don't even specialize in nonprofit work. We have CPAs in our office that do that, and could probably better answer your question. Usually, I'm dealing with once the income comes in on something like this. I farm it out to the other CPAs who specialize in it, because it's very very detailed and specialized. You know, I could come up off the top of my head with some generic transactions that would generate unrelated business taxable income. There's a huge amount of exceptions and a huge amount of rules that pertain to that, and you'd have to look at your exact transaction very specifically to see if that would generate it. And I wouldn't be able to give you that over the air.
Yeah, I know that generally the approach is to consider that it will be assessed unless you can find the exception, because there are so many exceptions.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
well, I think in the unrelated business expense or interest income, isn't that really has to do with where you have some kinds of income that's really not recognized for tax purposes, and then some of it is it's unrelated to whatever the business is, and it's coming in anyway. So it's you know, it's like if a nonprofit runs a car wash or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, an example is I invested in a non-performing promissory note. We were able to seek that owner who had basically abandoned the house and receive a deed in lieu of foreclosure, which put my IRA entitled to that property. I've now sold that property and would anticipate on closing that here within the next couple days. And based on my initial acquisition cost with some minor expenses for property upkeep, I'm going to realize, it's going to realize just under $10,000, which is a return on investment of just over 100% within a nine-month period. So my concern is that $10,000 that comes in as, you know, actually, in my way of looking at it, it's actually earnings within the IRA, but I want to make sure that that's not subject to the UBIT.
You are right on track. That's basically, if I got your call, we would be sitting down with the books and verifying the exact type of transaction. And I think you have reason to have to investigate this based on what you've indicated there. You know, first blush, you know, there's nothing wrong with making investment income, but does this exceed the rules they set around, like you say? So I think you're right on track to research this.
All right. Find it out. Thanks, guys.
Very good.
Thanks for your call. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back with more Investing Simplified. Hi, I'm Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and co-host of the radio program Investing Simplified. I recently left the Warren Allen Law Firm to open my own office. Professional and personable service have always been the hallmarks of my practice. I believe that this move will allow me to spend more time with my clients. For more than 37 years, it has been my privilege to assist clients with practical estate planning with wills, trusts, powers of attorney, advance directives, and other documents, so that they may have peace of mind knowing that their affairs are in order. When probate becomes necessary, emotions of family members may become fragile. Having an experienced attorney that can empathize with what the client is going through makes the process much easier. My new office is conveniently located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 101, just across from Mall 205, and my phone number is 971-229-0585. That's 971-229-0585.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney, with Carl's Comments. You can call Carl now at 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. It is time for Carl's Comments, and we welcome your calls about any other subject that you might want to have online. So anyway, Carl's Comments today, I'm going to follow up a little bit on the newspaper thing about unwritten agreements and stuff. And this is a fairly common issue that comes up, and that is, what do we do with the family beach house or the family cabin or the or if you're really lucky, the family island. I don't know. But it would be really a nice thing to do. And so, you know, a lot of times families have they have memories about this vacation place. They have, maybe they think it's going to be a possible retirement home for them. And they want to preserve it for the family. You know, they really do. And mom and dad want to keep the thing in the family as best they can. And all that kind of stuff. So those first two things, you know, memories of the family fun and possible home for retirement, are pretty easy to preserve, because you just don't give it up. Just, you know, don't sell it, don't get rid of it. You know, hang on to it till you die. That's one thing. But they're usually talking about that third thing, which is, how do we do that? How do we preserve it for the family after I die? That's usually the question that comes up. And that can be a little more complicated. And there are a number of factors that kind of come into play here when you're trying to save the family vacation spot, if you will. And first of all, is family dynamics. Do the kids, do they really share the fondness for the property that you do? Sometimes not. Do they get along with each other? I mean, really, do they really get along, or do they just maintain, you know, kind of a stressed peace? Do they socialize with each other? Do they get along enough so that they, you know, go out to dinner every now and then, or do they go on vacations together? Do they go on vacations at this place together? Those are all kind of things that I think would be indicative of how well that might work. And finally, I guess I would say, so, you know, so what, how are they in terms of their economic circumstances and philosophy? Do they mesh, or are there spendthrifts on one side and, you know, and extreme conservatives on the other? Are they successful, or are they in debt? Who knows? Those kinds of things are very important, because that's going to factor into how things work with preserving this asset. And this is another one. This is a real tricky one. How are the daughter-in-laws and son-in-laws involved in this? How much influence do they have? What would they think? Are they looking to sell this thing, or are they going to want to go enjoy the actual property itself? So those are things that you need to think about before you do something. And then, assuming that you've decided that you still want to do this, you want to arrange something for the family. There's nothing wrong with doing that. There's nothing wrong with doing that. But first of all, you really need a structure. And there are a number of ways to do it. Some I don't like as well as others, and so I'm just going to kind of talk about the general concepts. But first of all, you need some kind of a structure for keeping it and managing it. You know, you could do like an LLC. That's one way. I'm not as fond of that for a family thing, unless you have a tax issue. If you've got a tax issue, you know, in other words, an estate tax issue, and you want to maybe parcel it out in pieces, that might be a good thing. But I'm thinking in terms of, you know, when I die, I'm going to leave this to the kids, and I want them to keep it. And in that situation, that's where we could conceivably use a testamentary trust. And a testamentary trust would essentially have a trustee, and it could be the kids, it could be a kid, it could be somebody else, that essentially makes the decisions about the management and the operation of the facility or whatever it is. There are some pitfalls in that, because there might be some resentment in terms of, you know, who's running the show. There always can be, especially if it's the, you know, if it's the bully brother or the, you know, the salacious sister. You know, you never know. The other thing you can certainly do, and I think this is probably the most common and maybe the easiest thing to do, is to create what I call a co-tenancy agreement. We were talking earlier about, you know, that fellow that owns the property as tenants in common with his mother. Well, in that instance, everyone has a proportionate interest. So if it's a third, a third, a third, or, you know, well, now you've got multiple people possibly. You may have four people, six people, who knows, depending on how many siblings there are. And they all have some interest. You can obviously, if mom and dad decide to give different interests, that makes it even more complex. But supposedly they all have equal interest. So how do we do that? Well, what you can do is create in the trust or the will or whatever you want is a condition that says you don't get your share of this beach house unless you sign and agree to this co-tenancy agreement, which provides for the meaningful and logical and hopefully practical management of the property. And I've written the things, and they're, you know, they're not perfect, but they work, or they can work. So the kind of an agreement that we would have here would include a number of things. How are management decisions made? In other words, if you got to fix the roof, who decides who you're going to hire to fix the roof? I mean, those kinds of things doesn't sound like much now, but it can be a really big problem later on. Again, go back to that family dynamic thing about, you know, economic circumstances. Yeah, and then say, okay, so who's going to pay for all this? Who's going to pay for the insurance? Who's going to pay for the taxes? Who's going to pay for the maintenance? And how are you going to, and if you get a fight, how are you going to collect it? You know, that you're going to be, you know, suing people for their, you know, I mean, it's a difficult thing. So you have to have this cooperative spirit to really make it work pretty well. The biggest issue usually is what if you want to sell your part and the other people want to keep it, and there's nothing said about it? Then we go back to that partition suit that I was talking about, which is, you know, trying to force a sale or some kind of a buyout. So you can create a situation where there can be a buyout agreement that already fits, or any number of things. Obviously, if everybody agrees that they want to sell it, well, then they can sell it. But if three out of four want to sell it, and you know, then the other person doesn't, well, then there may be some kind of mechanism that you can write into the agreement that says that they can, you know, buy it or whatever they got to do to you know, to go along on, or that they lose. You know, you could just say, you know, majority rules, which can be a little bit harsh. So, but nonetheless, at least it solves the problem. At least then you don't have the lawsuit situation quite as often. So the main thing is that this can be very challenging for people to deal with. So I suggest, if you can't agree on things, you know, some kind of mediation is always a good thing to do. Just like we said in the newspaper article, none of these things should be subject to an unwritten agreement or family honor code. You know, throw that out the window. Mom dies, the glue of the family goes away, and you know, those unwritten codes get interpreted differently by different members. So don't do that. And like I said, get it in writing. So that's Carl's comments.
Very good. Well, it seems like family dynamics are a critical part of the planning on this. You know, basically you're going from one owner to multiple owners in a situation like mm-hmm. this, and the family dynamics are really going to determine how, you know, whether you're going to have to play a hard line or whether, you know.
It really does. It's a lot of, you know, you know what a condominium association is? You know what the difference between a herd of cats and condominium association is?
No.
There is no difference.
Oh.
So, okay. You know, same thing with the, you know, agreement. So anyway, we are going to take another quick break and come back with a little bit more Investing Simplified. We're going to get to the Knowledge Trust Minus One.
Hi, everybody. Chuck Price, the financial doctor here. If you're between ages 58 and 68, choosing Social Security benefits at the right time is one of the biggest financial decisions you'll ever make. You get one chance to get it right. After 12 months, there are no do-overs. 74% of Americans receive reduced benefits. Get your free report on 44 Social Security secrets at pfgwm.com. Social Security is often one of the largest and most mismanaged assets in your retirement income plan. Claiming benefits sounds easy. So is leaving up to $250,000 of your money with the government, or reducing your benefits up to 76% over your life expectancy. For this vital information, go online to pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000. We do Investing Simplified.